Okay, so lots of stuff about the middle way in the Buddhist tradition, but then there's lots of other stuff in the Buddhist tradition as well. And so I'm now going to talk about some of the things which I encounter when, or have encountered when I've talked to Buddhists about what are the priorities in Buddhism. What comes first? How should we actually make our judgments? What takes priority? And they would generally say things like the Four Noble Truths, conditionality, enlightenment, or the Three Jewels would be the prime things that come up. And my argument basically is that all these have something to tell us, but they all require the middle way to be understood or interpreted. Hence, I regard the middle way as more important or more basic than any of them. But so let's start with the Four Noble Truths. Have you all encountered the Four Noble Truths in some form?
Briefly, yeah.
Briefly, yeah. So the Four Noble Truths start with dukkha, so the experience of frustration or unsatisfactoriness, which is often translated as suffering. And the idea then, the second noble truth, that craving causes suffering. The third, that there is an alternative, there's enlightenment. And the fourth is the path which leads to the end of dukkha. And basically, it seems to me that all of those can be interpreted in an absolute or metaphysical way. So, for example, if you take the first one as, in that way, then you'll take our existence to be dominated by suffering, that we basically have a painful existence, which seems to me to be a over-absolute claim. Our experience is mixed. We have good experiences and bad experiences. So you could have, if you're going to make that kind of claim, you could start off with emphasis on the painful aspects of it, or you could, if you preferred, put the emphasis on the pleasant aspects of it and have a principle of sukha, which would be the principle of everything being ultimately happy. And either of those would appear to be just as valid on the surface as an interpretation of our experience. So, I guess what I've just done there is applied the middle way to the principle of dukkha, because I've just been saying, well, what's our experience, and this thing that's being claimed, is it quite as valid as it appears? Basically, as with any of these principles, if you take it as a statement of reality, then it will be an overstatement. If you try to draw out of it what is relevant to our experience, then it will be relevant to our experience. Obviously, all of these things have something to say to us. Same can apply to talk about craving as the source of dukkha is, and obviously our pains or even our frustrations seems to be are not necessarily entirely caused by craving, but obviously craving has a lot to do with them. So, we just need to consult our experience or indeed the evidence about what causes our problems. Enlightenment can be seen as a metaphysical absolute, or it can be seen as a sort of symbol of what we can work towards, which would be relevant to our experience. Okay, and then going to conditionality. So, again, particularly in Trivatna, where people tend to talk about conditionality as the ultimate or most important Buddhist principle, because Sangharakshita was talked in that vein. But again, you can interpret that as an absolute explanation of how things are. Things are conditioned. The universe is conditioned. But again, I'm not sure we have any call to do that, because although we might say, well, everything in, you know, our experience is conditioned, there are lots of things we haven't experienced. And the universe is, if not infinite, then impossibly vast, and we really don't know what's going on at the other end of it. So although all the laws of physics and so on, as we understand them, may tell us that everything's conditioned, we don't really know. Linked to that is the question for me as to whether it's useful to in any kind of claim is about reality or about the way things are, to have as the place where you start. I mean, that's something I'll come back to. So again, it seems to me that even that one, even though it appears to be wonderfully universal, requires the middle way to be interpreted. Enlightenment, I've already mentioned. You know, it could be seen as something completely abstract and beyond our experience, or it could be interpreted within our experience. And then the three jewels. Again, this is very much emphasised in Trivatna, which is something that Trivatna means, the three jewels. So the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So traditionally, the Buddha is the enlightened being. So if you have faith in the three jewels, you have faith in the enlightened being. You also have faith in the Dharma, which is the teachings of the Buddha, and the Sangha, which again traditionally is the Arya Sangha. So that means the community of stream entrants, so people who've got close to enlightenment but aren't quite there yet. And those are the only people who are really worthy of trust and faith. So faith in the three jewels, strictly speaking, in traditional Buddhism means that. All of which again seems to go beyond experience or justifiable confidence to me. But you can also relate them to our experience. Obviously, we all need role models and symbols and inspirations, so the Buddha can serve that purpose among other such inspirations and role models. And the Dharma, well, we all need philosophies and justified beliefs and so on, and the Sangha, but we need community, we need to support each other and so on. So three jewels can be interpreted in that sort of experienced way, again, or a metaphysical way. And then the authority of tradition, well, this depends on which school of Buddhism you're engaging with, but particularly in the Theravada or in Tibetan forms of Buddhism, or even in Zen, you get a lot of appeal to tradition as such. You know, the tradition of the lineage, for example, and the idea that the guru who started this particular school has got a particular insight and is passing on some unique teaching of the Buddha that's not accessible elsewhere. So again, obviously particular schools of Buddhism may have specific things to contribute, but it's the sort of absolute claim involved that's the problem here. Okay, so all that's basis of my argument here, that the middle way is the prime insight that we can get from the Buddhist tradition, and to interpret anything else or all the other principles that it offers us, we need the middle way in the first place. So then that, if you're encountering or engaging with Buddhist tradition, then leaves you with various practical judgments to make about how to respond to it. So there's a contradiction between the middle way and other kinds of priorities, if those priorities are interpreted as they often are in an absolute way. It seems to me that in the modern context, what we need most of all are the universal elements of what the Buddha has to offer us, which is, you know, another reason for adopting the middle way rather than something which appears to be more specific to a particular set of circumstances. And then, once you think you've understood those insights, to then apply them fully. So it seems to me the main task is much more about working out, well, what does the middle way imply in our circumstances, in a world of science and technology and globalization and so on. Whereas the emphasis in a lot of traditional Buddhism is much more on exploring what the tradition tells you fully, applying it as well, to be fair, but there's certainly seems to be a split of energy quite often between those two kinds of goals. But there comes a point where I don't feel the need to investigate the Buddhist tradition much further, because I think, well, actually that energy would be much better devoted to the practical goals of working out how we should apply it. And then also what I often encounter in the Buddhist tradition, and indeed elsewhere, even in Christian tradition, say, is what you might call the scholarly quagmire. So you make any kind of argument or claim about something related to Buddhism, and the challenge is, where's that in the canon? Can you prove it?
Mm-hmm.
Where does it say that? So you come up with something from the canon. Yes, there's the Kalama Sutta or this, whatever. And then, of course, there's the question of how you interpret that section of the scripture. And then you can go into a great deal of research to justify your position in relation to your interpretation of the scripture at that point, which will involve a lot of investigation of Indian history and archaeology and linguistics and Pali and investigating Buddhist tradition and how the texts have been transmitted and so on. All of which is fine. I mean, some of it's quite interesting. But very often it seems to me a big distraction from the key issues. And people get very worked up about it or consider it to be very important. And I suppose my personal experience is of having tried that route to some extent, because I started off when I was doing my first degree, I was in Cambridge, and well, for 2 years in Cambridge, I did Indian studies, which meant I was studying Sanskrit and Pali, and also Hindi. And so for a while, I was learning Pali, and I took quite a lot of interest in that kind of scholarly approach. One thing that struck me actually is that a lot of the scholars I met in Cambridge anyway weren't very interested in the practical application of the teachings at all. In fact, there were linguistically focused scholars who were quite contemptuous of Buddhism, such for example. But then even if you talk to Buddhist scholars, you know, there's this often this emphasis still on just the idea of justifying it from a traditional source, because that's believed to give you a connection with the Buddha and the word of the Buddha and the enlightenment of the Buddha. So obviously there is a whole spectrum of ways scholarship can be done, from almost sort of contemptuous, almost anti-Buddhist scholarship to deeply sympathetic, very traditional scholarship. But it all seems to me to be in danger of sinking into that quagmire quite often. So yeah, there was a point for me when I moved on from that, and I suppose rather dismayed some of the people I knew who were involved in scholarship by ceasing to be very interested in scholarship, in that I got much more interested in philosophy and what I could learn from that. So, yeah, what I think is a better way of approaching the middle way then is if we feel confident in the key insights of the Buddha, to then justify those not in terms of, well, the Buddha said this and we know for certain that the Buddha said this, but in terms of a pragmatic and philosophical justification. So, which would mean, firstly, it makes sense in a way we can understand and relate to our experience, and secondly, that if we try it out, then it continues to work as far as we've tried it out. Now, the way Buddhists often use that kind of justification, as well as a scholarly one, so it's a question of how much emphasis you put on any kind of justification. So I would say there's a point where you need to leave the scholarly justification behind to a greater extent than traditional Buddhists tend to do. There is an argument which I think is worth considering here, the conservative argument. And I mean, conservatives generally, with a small c, tend to emphasise, well, I suppose, the organic nature of our existence. So the fact that being fallible, mixed up physical beings, we live in a context with each other, and we depend on, well, traditions of interaction, and we depend on a kind of live transmission, for example, of any kind of insight, rather than just an abstract idea. So there's something to be said for that point, that conservatives in general tend to make, that, well, firstly, the change, if there is any, should be gradual, and secondly, well, particularly if you're talking about religious forms of conservatism, that the insights that religion may pass on may be non-verbal. So particularly you see that in the Zen tradition, and the idea of a transmission beyond the scriptures. There's a story of a guy seeing the Buddha and understanding what the Buddha said. Well, the Buddha held up a flower, that's right, instead of actually speaking, and ping. The guy got the point, and that was the beginning of the Zen tradition, is the story. So obviously are things like that. So, but for me, that provides a reason for engaging with the traditional traditions in various ways. But that's not really an argument for taking the authority positions of traditions at face value. If it's all, if we need gradual change, and we need openness to what people have discovered in the past, and we, you know, we can't just reinvent everything, sure, but at the same time, that also means at the same time that the past hasn't discovered everything, and the past, the way we interpret the past, isn't going to be completely accurate either. So, the way I can respect that conservative argument whilst not really accepting that at all as a reason for taking the Buddha's enlightenment as one's departure point, for example, or taking what we understand as the word of the Buddha as the departure point.